Gosh, you're coming to Murray State University on November 12th, and I'd like to begin with asking you how you're going to focus your presentation for the Gary Bogus Distinguished Lecture.
So I'm really focusing around a couple things. I mean, primarily I'll be celebrating the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, which is celebrating 100 years of research in Panama in 2014. And highlighting some of the science that we do. And also while doing that, really sort of highlighting our fellowship and internship program and what we do for young scholars. So as an institution, we host about 1,200 visitors a year. This sort of forms the core of our scientific community. Of that community, a huge proportion are young scholars. So these are undergraduates and graduate students. These are postgrads. These are students coming to Panama to be part of a course, whether we're talking about a semester-long course or a two-week capstone course. These are young people who are interested in biodiversity and understanding how it's generated and also understanding some of the threats to it.
Online, there's a YouTube production, I'm assuming by a graduate student, describing the environment and the scholarly research that goes on Barro Colorado Island. Describe the island and that rectangular area of inventory and how people track every living thing in that inventory of trees and plants and how you track the animals and who gets involved in that.
So Barro Colorado Island was formed when the Panama Canal was formed. So it was not always an island. It was part of the mainland or part of Panama, and was created as an island when the lake was formed to build the canal. You know, it's one of the places that tropical scientists have been studying for really a long time. So it's one of the best studied tropical forests in the world. And about 25 years ago, a group of scientists were thinking about, we don't really know that much about tropical forests. We know a fair bit about temperate forests. But what we do know about tropical forests suggests that we're not studying them on the right scale. You know, so for example, if you just look at number of tree species in the U.S., there's probably 10 times more tree species in Panama than there is across the entire North America. There is. And so they started thinking about ways to sort of start to understand these incredibly diverse ecosystems. And one of their ideas was, really what we need is a baseline. So we need a bit of forest. And in that forest, we want to know everything about the trees on it. We want to know every single tree that's of a size of about 1 centimeter if you measure it at your breast. So that's what they call diameter breast height. And so they did it. They went in there and this was in early 80s, they went and measured every single tree. And then from that, then they went back and measured it after 5 years, after 10 years. It was an experiment that really didn't start producing really interesting data or in the sense publications for about 10 years. But when it did, there were publications in major journals in Science and Nature and PNAS. And the number of scientists that started coming to BCI and studying this patch of forest increased. So not only were they studying what trees were there, they were studying when they were fruiting, they were studying how the fruits dispersed out of trees. They're even looking at how trees are interacting underground, what we're eating particular tree species. And in recognition of the importance of that experiment, they started replicating it. So not only in Panama, they started putting these types of experiments out in tropical forests or in forests around the world. And that sort of gave birth to something that we call SIGEO, which is a global initiative in which you have over 100 of these forest plots around the globe. And they're linked together by a series of scientists that are interested in understanding the processes that occur within forests. And to understand it, they recognize that you've really got to study it on a regional or a global basis. And to really make sense of it, you've got to collect data in a very, very similar way. You know, that first experiment gave birth to what now is a global initiative made up of over 100 countries and, really thousands of scientists.
That's really neat. What is your personal research interest?
I'm interested in variation. So I'm interested in why there's so many species. And I'm particularly interested in variation that allows individuals to survive and reproduce. So variation that's adaptive, for example. And a lot of my research is sort of trying to identify within an organism what genes are involved in generating traits that are adaptive, that are important for survival and reproduction. I started as a marine biologist working on butterfly fishes because I was interested in why there's so many reef fish and the importance of color pattern in the biology of a reef fish. And then I moved on to studying tropical butterflies, mainly because you could make the connections between a way a butterfly looked, in this case I'm looking at the wing patterns, and how it survived in particular environments. And I'm very much a geneticist, and I'm very much interested in understanding what are the genes that are involved in changing a wing pattern. So I work on a group of butterflies called Heliconias that are really remarkable for their variation in color pattern, so that you have within a species on the order of 30 different color pattern forms. And the other thing that's remarkable about this group is you have different species really converging on the same pattern. And that's really driven by natural selection. So these color patterns are warning colors. These butterflies taste bad. As larvae, they feed on a plant and they sequester cyanide, essentially. And this makes the adults taste bad. And the things that eat them, which are mainly birds, learn to associate a bad taste with a particular pattern, and they simply don't eat them. So we knew a lot about the ecological significance of these bright, vivid patterns. And I was really interested in understanding how you make a pattern from a genetic point of view. And that really has been work that sort of evolved over the last 10 years, starting from just being able to look at DNA sequences to being able to sequence the whole genome of individuals in half a day at a fraction of the cost that I could do it when I started out. Over the past year, there's been some exciting discoveries on how you make a butterfly wing pattern. One that I'm particularly proud of came out in Science about a year ago, in which we showed a gene that actually is important in making an eye. The gene's called optics. Also colors a butterfly wing pattern red. So, you know, my research is really sort of trying to understand the connections between changes at the level of the DNA to changes that generate variation that we see in nature, and understanding how nature selects particular variants allows them to survive. Did I lose you there?
No, I get it. I mean, I couldn't get it on my own, but you explained it very clearly. And speaking about research over time, one of the senior colleagues there said that what was fascinating about STRI was its ability to foster both very large group projects and individual projects. So there are lots of intersections and lots of differences and room for originality.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly right. I mean, so I'm coming down to STRI. I've been here for about 3 years from an academic environment. So I'm coming from North Carolina State, the genetics department. And, you know, as a scientist, you spend a lot of time writing grants, and those grants tend to last on the order of 3 years. And it's very difficult to maintain continuity, when in fact what you really need to ask some of the bigger questions is continuity. You need to have an experiment, set it up, and be able to let it play forward for decades. And this is why BCI is in the 40-hectare plot or so, such a great experiment. But it's very difficult to get that type of money to run a project, to start a project, and then have it go for 10 or 20 years. But because the Smithsonian in Panama receives both public and private money, we have the ability to do that. And that generates extraordinary resources for people to take advantage and leverage the legacy of data that has come before to reevaluate, reanalyze it, place it into a larger temporal context than you could if you were going from one grant cycle to the next grant cycle in a traditional research institution.
I understand, in addition to the scholarly work there, that you allow civilians to come see and get involved in some ways?
Yeah, we're trying to find clever ways to do that better, recognizing two things. You know, one, we're unique in the sense that, you know, we're one of the few places that has access to tropical forests and tropical reefs. As part of the Smithsonian Institution, we're the nation's museum. you know, we really have an obligation to U.S. citizens to provide them opportunities. The issue is, you know, how do we do that effectively, recognizing that we're primarily a research institute. And so we've really started trying, you know, just like when I came down as academic dean, trying to sort of focus and align our scholarship with our science, we're trying to focus and align our outreach activities. We have a public face with Panama, so we have a marine interpretive center at Culebra that gets hundreds of thousands of visitors per year. Visitors go to BCI for tours, and you know, finding ways in which we can sort of celebrate our science, celebrate Panama, celebrate tropical diversity is one of the things that we're sort of trying to do better, and you know, trying to sort of leverage what the strength of our science, and going forward, trying to figure out ways to spread the word a little bit. I mean, it's always surprising to me how few people know that the Smithsonian has a tropical research institute in Panama. I mean, every time I go through customs, I get the question, you know, where are you coming from? I said, Panama. He goes, what are you doing there? And I said, I work for the Smithsonian. And then, you know, I go, what do you mean? The Smithsonian's in D.C. And I have to explain to them that the Smithsonian is, you know, that's where the museums are, but there's research institutes associated with the Smithsonian that are outside of the mall. And we're the only research institute that's out of the continental U.S.